Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa.
Okay. Did everybody get the handouts? There should be two handouts. One is the 10 epithets of the Buddha, and the other is the main paradigm of the gradual training. Okay, I guess everybody has gotten. Wait till. There are some people in the back who didn't get the handout. Okay, last week we had just started to study Sutta number 27 in the middle length discourses, the Chula Hati Padopama Sutta. This is the shorter discourse on the simile of the elephant's footprint, which begins on page 269 of the book. And I'll just summarize what I covered last time. The sutta begins when a prominent Brahmin named Janusoni, he was the chaplain to King Pasenadi of Kosala. He is leaving the city of Savati in a very distinguished chariot, drawn an all-white chariot drawn by all-white mares. And he sees a wanderer pilot named Pilotika who is coming in the distance, and he asks him where he is coming from. And this wanderer Pilotika says that he is coming from the presence of the recluse Gotama, that is the Buddha. And then the Brahmin Janusoni asks whether this wanderer considers the Buddha to be a wise man, and the wanderer replies that he's not really qualified to judge the Buddha's wisdom, since the Buddha is praised by those who are much wiser than himself. And then Janusoni asks him why he has such high opinion of the ascetic Gotama of the Buddha. And he explains, he uses the simile of the elephant's footprint. He says that if a wise elephant woodsman, that's a person who goes trying to track down elephants in the woods in order to catch, this is the kings in this period, or even not only the kings, well, especially the kings would like to catch elephants to use for the labor of the capital. And even very prominent businessmen would catch elephants to use for work projects, construction projects. And so to get elephants, you have to track them down in the jungle, and you have to know where to find them. And especially prized would be the big bull elephants, the tusker elephants. Even though this is still the case, I have to say, in Sri Lanka today, I've seen it with my own eyes, how the big tusker elephants are especially prized. And so one has to know how to find them, and the way to find them is by tracking them in the woods, using getting a skilled elephant hunter to track their footprint. And he has to look in the woods where the elephants wander and be able to judge from their footprints which are the footprints of a big bull elephant. Yeah, please come and take a seat. And so now this wanderer is explaining that suppose a wise elephant foot woodsman were to enter the elephant woods, and he would see there a big elephant's footprint, long in extent and broad across, and he would come to the conclusion, this is a big bull elephant. And so, now he draws the simile, so when I saw four footprints of the recluse Gotama, I came to the conclusion that the Blessed One is fully enlightened, the Dhamma, the doctrine, is well proclaimed by the Blessed One, and the Sangha, that's the order of the Buddha's disciples, is practicing the good way. And what are these four footprints? First, he has seen certain learned, very accomplished, noble Kshatriyas, members of the aristocratic class, who are knowledgeable about many philosophical doctrines. They make a plan to meet the Buddha, to meet the ascetic Gotama, and try to trip him up in debate. But when they go to meet him and try to set traps and trick him, instead of setting their traps, they listen to his discourse and become converted to his teaching. And the same thing happens with very skilled, wise, learned Brahmins. They listen to his teaching and they become converted. Also, learned householders, skilled in the doctrines of others, they want to engage him in debate. They go to listen to him and they get converted and become his followers. And then learned recluses, these are the wanderers, the ascetics, who have devoted their lives to the quest for liberation. They think the Buddha is following, teaching a wrong doctrine. They want to debate with him. They listen to his discourse, and they realize that he is teaching the true way to enlightenment and liberation. And then they become monks under him, follow his teaching, and reach the final goal through his instruction. So these, according to this wanderer, these are the four footprints of the ascetic, of the recluse Gotama, on the basis of which he is full confidence that this ascetic Gotama is indeed the fully enlightened one. Okay, when this was said, then the Brahmin Janusoni gets down, pays homage to the Buddha. Just in his own mind, he's not in the presence of the Buddha, but with his own mind, he extends his hands in salutation in the direction of the Buddha's monastery and says, honor Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa, three times. And he says, maybe sometime, he expresses the wish, maybe sometime I might meet Master Gotama and have some conversation with him. I think that's as far as we got last time. Now we're on page 271, paragraph 9. Okay, and now apparently, sometime, maybe a little later, the Brahmin Janusoni has made it a point to go to the Blessed One. Of course, the Buddha's main monastery was at the Jetas Grove. This is the park donated by the wealthy householder Anathapindika. And so the Brahmin Janusoni went to the Buddha, exchanged greetings with him, and then after this exchanging friendly conversation, he sat down and related his conversation with the wanderer. And at this point, then the Buddha said to him, at this point, Brahmin, the simile of the elephant's footprint has not yet been completed in detail. As to how it is completed in detail, listen and attend carefully to what I shall say. And the Brahmin says, yes, sir. And the Buddha continues. And now, in the next paragraph, we're going to see what I take to be a distinct sign of the historical Buddha's real particular, at least one feature of his real specific genius. In this earlier, as I related this earlier discourse, there was one little logical fallacy which we could easily have overlooked, probably all of us did. But the Buddha, and how the Buddha, as a wandering ascetic, would have been able to catch that fallacy is something which is quite remarkable. But he brings it up in the next paragraph. Suppose an elephant woodsman were to enter an elephant wood and were to see in the elephant wood a big elephant's footprint, long in extent and broad across. Now the Buddha was not trained as an elephant woodsman, but he knows how an elephant woodsman would think. He says, a wise elephant woodsman would not yet come to the conclusion, indeed, this is a big bull elephant. This is a point of inferential logic, you could say. Why is this? It's something based on experience. Because in an elephant wood, there are small female elephants that have big feet. And they would leave a big footprint. And this might be one of their footprints. It's a little bit like, you know, one says, there's a line that, okay, all crows are black. X is a crow, therefore X is black. Well, maybe it's not the case that all crows are black. There might be albino crows, which are white. And X might be an albino crow, so maybe X is a crow, but it's not black. Okay, so the elephant woodsman follows it, he goes along, and now he sees in the elephant wood a big elephant's footprint, long in extent and broad across, and some scrapings high up. Now, if there's a big bull elephant, a further telltale sign would be that there are scrapings high up, because the elephant, when it goes through the jungle, it will scrape against the high trees and leave scraping marks against the trunks of the trees. So one might conclude there's a big bull elephant here. But a real sharp-minded elephant hunter wouldn't draw that conclusion right away. For he knows that here the translation is a little defective. Let's see. Some scrapings high up. A wise elephant woodsman would not yet come to the conclusion, indeed, this is a big bull elephant. The translation says, why is that? In an elephant wood, there are tall she elephants that have prominent teeth. I mean, that's, I think, the best one could do in the translation, but the way the Pali reads, it seems like this is a particular type of elephant. It's not just that there are some elephants that have prominent type, but it's a particular type of elephant with prominent teeth. And they leave, well, they have big footprints, and they might be scraping against the tops of the trees with their prominent teeth. It's not necessarily the case that they're big bull elephants scraping against the tree. Okay, so the elephant hunter goes a little further. And then he sees in the elephant wood big elephant's footprint, long in extent and broad across, some scrapings high up again. Still, it's a strong sign that there might be a big bull elephant, but not a conclusive sign. And then marks that look like they might be made by tusks. Now, a wise elephant woodsman, still, if they were indeed made by tusks, one could come to the conclusion that there's a tusker. It's a big elephant with tusks. A big bull elephant with tusks, but the wise, truly wise elephant woodsman doesn't yet come to that conclusion. Why is that? Again, in the text, the Pali text, it says that there's a particular class or type of elephant. In the elephant wood, there's a type or class of tall she-elephants that have tusks and leave a big footprint. And this might be one of their footprints. So again, his evidence is getting stronger and stronger, but it's not yet strong enough to draw the conclusion. Like, this is the mark of the Buddha. He's a very rigorous thinker. Like, he won't draw a conclusion unless there's completely compelling evidence for it, and particularly direct empirical evidence, direct, what I call ocular, experiential evidence. Okay, so now he's the elephant hunter. He's following the elephant footprint further, further, and he sees in the elephant wood a big elephant's footprint, long in extent, broad across. He's still seeing the scrapings high up. He's seeing marks made by tusks, broken off branches. And then he comes to a clearing in the woods, and he looks ahead, and there he sees it, that wonderful sight. It's really wonderful when you see that bull elephant in the woods. The bull elephant at the root of the tree, or walking or in the open space, walking about, sitting, lying down, and he comes to the conclusion, this is that big bull elephant. And so now he sees for himself. And so he doesn't have to draw the conclusion inferentially. It's not a matter of inference or just logical deduction. But now he sees with his own eye that this is the elephant right before me. And so he's followed the elephant's footprint, and they've led him to the elephant. And now he knows that there is indeed a big bull elephant in the woods. Okay, so now the Buddha is going to apply the simile. And he's going to do so by introducing a fixed paradigm, which occurs many times with a number of variations throughout the discourses. We have a somewhat more elaborate version that occurs in the Digha Nikaya, the long discourses, and then a somewhat more compressed version that occurs in the Majjhima Nikaya, in the middle length discourses. And this sequence or pattern opens with a paragraph which describes the appearance, the arising of the Buddha in the world. And it begins with a fixed formula which enumerates the Buddha's qualities or primary epithets. So we have this paragraph. So too, Brahman, hear a Tathagata appears in the world, accomplished, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime, knower of worlds, incomparable leader of persons to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, enlightened, blessed. Okay, this is a very, very important little statement which compresses into one sentence many of the most important qualities or characteristics that describe the Buddha. And so the commentators have elaborated upon the meanings of these terms at great length. We've come across this paragraph or this sentence earlier when we've gone through the suttas in the previous section last year. But I didn't want to elaborate upon the meanings of these terms at that point because I wanted the class to gather a certain momentum before I explain them at length. But now I think it's the appropriate time to do so. Okay, so first we take the word Tathagata. The word Tathagata is the word that the Buddha uses most often with reference to himself. Whenever he is referring to himself, not so much as an individual historical person as the person Gautama, but rather when he's referring to himself as a Buddha, as a fully enlightened one, then he uses this word Tathagata. And the exact meaning, the exact original meaning of the word, I have to say, is really not known and not understood. But the whole Buddhist tradition has given very elaborate explanations of it. In later Buddhist tradition, we have the explanation that Tathagata, you have in Chinese the word Ru Lai. You have the explanation that Tathagata is the one who comes from suchness. But the idea of suchness as a kind of philosophical principle is, of course, a later Buddhist concept. It's not intrinsic to the early Buddhist teaching. And then even the Chinese translation, Ru Lai, is a kind of choice out of two possible meanings of the Pali or Sanskrit. Because in Pali and Sanskrit, we have a certain type of formation that we call sandhi. Sandhi is the joining of two words to form another word. So the word Tathagata could be formed from either tattha plus agata or tattha plus gatta. Tattha, the word tattha means thus or such. And agata means come. So Tathagata as tattha plus agata would be thus come, the thus come one. That would be the Chinese Ru Lai. But Tathagata could also be tata thus plus gata, gone. In that case, it could have been Ru Chi. And now this word, Tathagata, was not unique to Buddhism. But it seems that, well, from the evidence of the text, it was used in many of the spiritual communities contemporary with the Buddha to designate the perfectly accomplished person within their own spiritual discipline. So the word Tathagata, many of these schools use the word Tathagata to mean the person who had reached the supreme or ultimate attainment. And there were debates going on in all of these schools. What is the destiny of the Tathagata, the accomplished one, after death? Does he exist? Does he not exist? And so it seems that the Buddha took this term over from the contemporary usage, and then it became a quite characteristic term within his own system. And though the term is not given any kind of systematic explanation within the very early Buddha scriptures, but the Buddhist commentators have tried to find ways to read almost the entire meaning of Buddhist doctrine in this one term, Tathagata. The Pali commentators derive, try to explain the word Tathagata in terms of 8 derivations, but I've taken only the two, what I think are the two most important ones here. One is Tathagata as Tathagata, the one who has thus come. And the commentators say he is called thus come because he has come to Buddhahood thus. Thus means in the same way that all the Buddhas of the past have come to it. That is, by fulfilling the 10 spiritual perfections, the 10 paramis, by making, there are a certain number of great sacrifices, the self-sacrifices that he has to make, by acting for the welfare of himself, the welfare of his relations, the welfare of the world. There are different categories of requisites that have to be fulfilled to attain Buddhahood. And since every Buddha arrives at Buddhahood by fulfilling these same requisites, they are all said to come or to arrive at Buddhahood thus, in the same way. And then the other most important meaning, doctrinal meaning of Tathagata, is tata plus gata, thus gone. And here the commentaries read into this the sense that he is gone to nirvana thus. That is, he is gone to nirvana in the same way that all the liberated ones have gone to nirvana. That is, by practicing the 4 satipatthanas, the 4 foundations or establishments of mindfulness. Here they bring in the 37 aids to enlightenment, the 4 right efforts and so on, the 7 factors of enlightenment, the Noble Eightfold Path. To find out the others, you have to come to the Saturday afternoon lectures. Okay, so this is, in brief, Tathagata. But the Pali commentator Buddhaghosa gives 8 explanations. Some of them are quite fanciful. Then his successor, the commentator Dhammapala, is not content with 8, but he has to pile on still a few more through his own ingenuity. So it becomes, quote, get page after page after page of the most complicated Pali. But I think this is quite sufficient to know these 2 main explanations. Okay, the next epithet or designation, which is translated here, not so happily, accomplished, is actually the word arahan or arahat, alohan. And this too, this was another word which was used among the different spiritual communities even prior to the arising of the Buddha. And it's a word which is still used in Jainism. The word arahang comes from the verb arahati, which means to be worthy. And so the term seems to have arisen from the question, who is truly worthy of respect and veneration? And from the attempt to answer that question, the answer came that the one who is truly worthy of respect and veneration is one who has completely eliminated all mental defilements, all the pollutions, corruptions of the mind, and the one who has completely achieved complete liberation from all of the bonds of conditioned existence. This was the shared understanding amongst many of the ascetic communities during the time of the Buddha. And so when the Buddha arose and claimed to be the Arahant, an Arahant, he wasn't using the term that was a special creation of his own. But he was taking the, again, he was taking a term that was part of like the common usage and then making it, giving it meanings which were specific to the doctrinal framework of his own teaching. And so within the Buddha's teaching, the Arahat, the Buddha as Arahat, well, the word Arahat is used not only for the Buddha himself, but for the Buddha and all disciples of the Buddha who achieve this complete purification of the mind and liberation from the cycle of birth and death. And they are held to be, for this reason, that they are all worthy to receive the veneration, not only of human beings, but even of the devas and brahmas, the gods and the deities. Okay, the next epithet of the Buddha is Sammasambuddho, which means fully enlightened one, perfectly or perfectly enlightened one. As a kind of explanation of this, one might take the statement in Sutta number 12, that's the Mahasihanada Sutta. This would be on page 167, amongst the four kinds of intrepidity or four kinds of self-confidence. One kind of self-confidence that the Buddha claims, paragraph 23, is he sees no ground on which anyone, any ascetic, Brahmin, God, anyone in the world could say, accuse him thus, while you claim full enlightenment, you are not fully enlightened in regard to certain things, certain dhammas. So in other words, it's said that the Buddha is one who has become fully enlightened to all dhammas, all things. What this means is, I have to say, it's a little vague, and of course later commentators come to the conclusion that, in fact, the Buddhist tradition as a whole comes to the conclusion that the Buddha is omniscient, and some say he knows everything, past, present, and future, and even later Buddhist tradition says every hair pore of the Buddha's body knows everything past, present, and future. But whether the Buddha would have known how many deer graze on the lawn of Bodhi Monastery on February 16th, 17th, 2004, I don't know that he would have considered that especially worth knowing. So I would prefer to understand what is meant by knowing all dhammas to mean that he knows all principles relating to everything relevant to the way to enlightenment and liberation. And maybe, okay, everything that he is significant, that is important to know, that is in any way relevant to the quest for liberation, anything that will be of benefit to living beings and helpful in guiding them to liberation, will come within the scope of the Buddha's faculty of knowledge. But having said that, I should also add that I'm continually amazed when reading the discourses just how incredible the range of the Buddha's capacity for composing similes is. To me, that seems to boggle my mind and convince me that if he doesn't know the number of deer on the lawn of Bodhi Monastery, he knows so many things about so many spheres of knowledge that just an ordinary person with an ordinary faculty of knowledge could hardly gather so much information and be able to spontaneously compose similes right on the spot, which work in such intricate detail. That is what continually boggles my mind. Okay, then in the Pali tradition, there's a work that might date about the 2nd century BC, several centuries after the Buddha's passing away, called the Patisamvida Magga, which tries to elaborate upon the types of knowledge that pertain to the Buddha's enlightenment. It elaborates a scheme of 72 types of knowledge. And amongst these, it includes what's called the knowledge of omniscience and the unobstructed knowledge. And it says that whatever dhammas there are, past, present, and future, all come within range of the Buddha's faculty of knowledge. But within the sutta texts themselves, the Buddha does not explicitly claim omniscience in the sense of knowing every particular fact. In fact, there's the sutta where he explicitly denies having such knowledge. Okay, the next characteristic is Vijja Charana Sampanna, which is translated perfect in true knowledge and conduct. Here, by Vijja, knowledge, superior knowledge, is meant the three true or higher knowledges that the Buddha attained on the night of his enlightenment. This is the knowledge of the recollection of past lives, the ability to recollect his past lives over many, many aeons of world expansion, worlds of contraction. And the second is the ability to know the arising and passing away of beings from one state of existence to another. That is, he can use his special faculty of vision to look out upon the world and see how, right at the present moment, how beings are passing away, and then how they take rebirth in other realms in accordance with their karma, with their actions, their volitional actions. And then the third type of knowledge that he achieved on the night of his enlightenment was the knowledge of the destruction of the defilements. He saw how those root defilements that had kept him in bondage to samsara through beginningless time, he saw how those defilements had been completely uprooted so that they could never arise again. And he knew that now these defilements were utterly obliterated, so the mind is completely free, completely purified. And then the conduct, or the charana, this is explained as there are some suttas which explain what is meant by conduct, and it gives that list of various factors such as the moral restraint, control of the senses, and included amongst conduct, it's not only moral conduct, but also mastery of the various meditative attainments, the jhanas, samadhis, that the Buddha can enter into any meditative absorption, any concentration, move through all of these samadhis and concentrations freely, according at will. And he can guide others in the attainment of these samadhis according to their faculties. But that's going a little too quickly. I'm getting ahead of myself. Okay, then briefly, the commentaries say, when we speak of perfect and true knowledge and conduct, true knowledge is the knowledge of whatever is good and harmful for other beings, and conduct is compassionate action to steer them away from what is harmful and direct them to what is beneficial. Okay, now the next word, the next term, again, any translation, it's not good. Sublime. This, I have to shift the blame here onto Venerable Nyanamoli. I just accepted what he used. But the Pali, it's hard to translate. The word sugata, su has the sense of good or well, and gata is gone, just like tathagata. So su plus gata would be something like well gone, which doesn't make sense, or good gone, well gone one. But the commentaries, and again, this was a term that seemed to have been used quite widely amongst the spiritual communities of the Buddha's time. And the Pali commentaries understand it as having two implications. One is that he is well gone in the sense that he has gone along the good path, that is the Noble Eightfold Path. And second, that he has gone to the good state, that is he has reached the deathless state, the immortal state, nirvana. I think in my Sanyutta Nikaya translation, I changed sublime one to fortunate one. Again, it's just an approximation. So it's interesting, in medieval India and in like the Hindu doctrinal treatises, when they refer to the Buddhists, they usually refer to them as the Saugatas, the followers of the Sugata. So it seems that they took the Buddha to be known primarily as the Sugata rather than as the Buddha. Okay, next is Loka Vidu, knower of the world. And this, the text themselves seem to substantiate this meaning, that there are, the word world is used in different senses in the suttas. And so when the Buddha is said to be the knower of the world, it can be understood in different ways. One sense of world is the world of living beings, that there are different realms, many realms of existence. And even within this visible realm of existence, there are many, many different types of people with their own different mental tendencies. Then there are the animals and other beings which are not visible to us. And so the Buddha is one who knows this world of living beings with all the differentiations from the highest heavenly realms and above them the Brahma realms, the divine realms, down to the lowest realms, the infernal realms. All of these come within the scope of the Buddha's knowledge. Then the word world is used in the sense of what I call the astronomical or geographical world. This is the sense of the world system spread out in measureless space and time. And even though the Buddhist account of the, you might call the astronomical world, doesn't agree exactly with that of modern science, but I have to say it comes quite remarkably close compared to any other system in any ancient religion. Like the Buddha speaks about time going back immeasurable aeons upon aeons upon aeons. And they speak about world systems upon world systems spread out inconceivable spatial distances. And all of this comes, at least to some extent, within the sphere or domain of the Buddha's knowledge, at least the basic, say the basic outlines of this astronomical system. That's not the, all the details. And then the third sense of world is something quite specific to the Buddhist system. This is what is called, in Pali it's called Sankhara Loka. So this is a conception of the world that in a sense reflects the specific Buddhist insight into the nature of existence. That is, we now have the world or existence seen as constituted by different types of component factors, conditioned and conditioning factors, elements, components, impermanent, conditioned, and conditioning factors, which are assigned to different schemes of classification that we find running through the suttas, like the Buddha's wisdom or faculty of knowledge, the sex the universe into these different classes of conditioned phenomena, the five aggregates, material form, feelings, perceptions, volitional formations, consciousness, then the 12 sense bases, that's the six sense faculties, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, the six objects, form, sound, smell, taste, touch, mental objects, the 18 elements, that's six sense faculties, six sense objects, six types of consciousness. So the Buddha is able to see how the entire world is just a flux of conditioned phenomena, and he's able to see how these phenomena fall into these different classes of components. In that sense, he is a knower of the world. Okay, now it seems to me, this is my understanding, that these first six epithets of the Buddha deal principally with the Buddha's personal attainment. Those qualities that pertain to the Buddha and establish him as one who is enlightened, fully enlightened within himself. But now, with the seventh quality onwards, these we see the Buddha as one who is enlightened for others. Now, the Buddha's enlightenment, in a sense, spills out towards the world and establishes him in his role as teacher, transformer, and spiritual guide for others. And so we come to number seven. The Buddha is Anuttaro Purisa Dhammasarati. He is the incomparable, again the wording here, leader, it's weak. I like trainer of tameable persons. Because Sarathi is the one who drives the chariot, who has to train the horses to lead the chariot. Leader, it doesn't really get that full image. And Dhamma is used after Asa Dhamma, that's horses to be trained, and Hatti Dhamma, the elephants to be trained. So when you say Purisa Dhamma, those are persons to be trained, to be tamed and trained. And so just as the elephant trainer trains horses, no, the elephant trainer doesn't train. Just as the elephant trainer trains elephants to do the work for the king, and just as the horse trainer trains horses to lead the chariot, so the Buddha, he finds people, even sometimes rough, violent people, deluded people, proud, arrogant people. And he trains them and tames them, breaks them in, transforms them, and makes them into wise, enlightened, noble people, enlightened individuals. And then to explain this, the text gives various examples, such as the serial killer Angulimala, the proud debater Satchika. And there was even the elephant named Nalagiri who came to the Buddha. He was sent by the Buddha's cousin Devadatta to kill him. And the Buddha, through the radiance of his loving kindness, his metta, transformed the elephant and made him very tame and gentle. Okay, then continuing along this line, we come to 8. The Buddha is Satta Deva Manusanam, teacher of gods and humans, teacher of the devas. The devas are the deities, and above the deities, even the Brahmas, the higher divinities in the higher world. Okay, then there are various suttas that one finds, I don't want to refer to them now, but throughout the Nikayas, one sees in numerous suttas how the Buddha teaches not only human beings, but also the gods from the different deva worlds. Particularly, one should look in the Samyutta Nikaya, first chapter, Deva Samyutta. We see the devas in the middle of the night when the rest of the world is sleeping, or at least the rest of the part of India where the Buddha is living is sleeping. The Buddha is still awake, and during that certain hours of the night, the devas from the heavenly world, they come to the Buddha, shedding their radiance over the monastery. They appear before him, ask their questions, and the Buddha teaches them and answers their questions. And sometimes the Buddha himself will go from the human realm to these higher realms, even the Brahma world, to teach the beings in those worlds. Okay, then the 9th epithet is that by which we know Gotama best. That is Buddha. And then this was the question that came to my mind. If we have Sammasambuddha as the title number 3, perfectly or fully enlightened, then why have Buddha as characteristic number 9? Aren't they the same thing? But what strikes me is that the preceding characteristics, trainer of tameable persons, teacher of gods and humans, are qualities which establish the Buddha as a teacher and trainer. So Buddha here must be not simply the enlightened one who is himself enlightened, but also one who enlightens others. And the commentary also explains it that way. It says it's not only Buddha's past participle as enlightened, but it also explains it by, it uses a causative form.
Pali
Buddha. What's the nominative singular? Nominative singular? 3 of 3 Pali students here. We didn't get to this lesson yet, so don't worry about it. You drop the R and make that A elongate, bodhita, bodhita, which means one who enlightens, one who awakens. And that is, he enlightens others to the four truths, the four noble truths. Bodhita. It is a commentarial word, but to me it makes good sense as an explanation of the significance of Buddha. I mean, taken on its own, Buddha means just simply enlightened, and it would imply one who has understood him, who is enlightened himself, who has understood himself. But the question would be, why should it come? Why would you have to say Buddha if you've already said Sammasambuddha? It seems even like a weaker term than Sammasambuddha. Since Sammasambuddha means perfectly, fully enlightened, as Buddha is just enlightened, then why should it come at so late? And then we come finally to the tenth term. Again, blessed is just not really satisfactory at all, but I don't know what to do with it. The word, the Pali Sanskrit word, is just so rich. Bhagava. It's sort of like the most exalted word that one could use for any teacher in Indian religion. Like every Indian religion, its most exalted personage is called, they call it Bhagava. Like for the Vaishnavites, the followers of Vishnu, then Vishnu would be their Bhagava, Krishna would be their Bhagava. For the Shaivites, Shiva is Bhagava. Yeah, the Bhagavad Gita is the song of Bhagava, Krishna. But for the Buddhists, it's Gautama who is Bhagava. The word Bhaga, it has the sense, again, of fortune, share, portion. Va is one who possesses. But you can't... It's difficult to get a rendering just by taking the word literally. But the way it's explained in the commentary, I gave a quotation from Visuddhimagga. Bhagava is a term signifying the respect and veneration given to him as the highest of all beings and distinguished by his excellent qualities, as the ancient commentator said, deserving honor and veneration, he is given the name Bhagava. And the Chinese, or the translators into Chinese of the Sanskrit text, tried to capture the same meaning with the word Shidzun, which is world venerated or world honored one. Obviously, both in the southern tradition and northern Sanskrit tradition, they had the same understanding of the word Bhagava, the one who is honored, venerated as the highest of all beings, because of his excellent qualities. And then the commentaries, of course, Pali commentaries, go on to pages enumerating different qualities to try to show why he is Bhagava. Then they also introduce what I call playful derivations. Like there's a word, bhaga, which means broken. So they say, why is he called Bhagava? Because he is Bhagaraga. That means he is broken lust. Bhagga dosa, he's broken the hatred. Bhagga moha, he's broken delusion. Bhagga sabakilesa bandha, he's broken all defilements, bonds, fetters, pain, underlying mental afflictions, and so on and so forth. This is Goenka. This is the way that he gives this explanation in his one of his discourses. Okay, so so this will be the basic talk for this evening. Though it's just focused all on one sentence, I think it's about time to explain all of these qualities of the Buddha that we've come across several times already. Now, if there's any questions, comments, please feel free to speak. Yeah. Asava, the word asava. Yeah, that's the word, again, the exact meaning is a somewhat obscure. Okay, the word he's asked about is asava.
This is kind of
low. Anyway, you know what I mean. Yeah, the word asapa, I think it, you brought it up because it occurs in connection with arhat. One who has destroyed all of the asavas. Yeah, so the arhat is called keen asava, which means one who has destroyed the asavas. Now, the word asava comes from a, that's the prefix, plus the root su, which means to flow. And so from su we get the verb savati, to flow. But the prefix a could have indicate flow moving in either direction, flowing in or flowing out. And what exactly is intended originally is not exactly, nobody is exactly sure. But the term was used, again, as a term which was used before the rise of Buddhism. It was used by the Jains. It was used by the Jains before the rise of Buddhism, and the term was taken over by the Buddha to designate the defilements, the most basic defilements that keep the round of samsara moving. We'll actually come to the term. Actually, we're going to come to the word later in the sutta. Maybe let me explain the word when we come to it in the course of the sutta, okay? We come to it towards the end of the sutta, so I'll explain it there. If I give the ending away before we get to it, nobody will come for the rest of the class. Any further questions? Yes. Omniscience, yes. Do I know which sutta it is? Yeah, it's Majjhima Nikaya number 71. But I have to add to that that it's a specific type of omniscience that he denied. If you look at the sutta, it's in the same book, 71, page 587. Some wanderer named Vachagota has heard a report that the Buddha claims to be omniscient and all-seeing, to have complete knowledge and vision, that whether I am walking or standing or sleeping or awake, knowledge and vision are continuously and uninterruptedly present to me. That is, so what he denies is that he has knowledge and vision, or in other words, knowledge, all knowledge, omniscience, continuously and uninterruptedly present all the time and in all activities. And then he asks whether this is true or whether this is a misrepresentation. And then the Buddha says that this is a misrepresentation. And then the wanderer says, how should I explain correctly in accordance with the Dhamma. And then the Buddha says, if you answer thus, you can say, if you want to speak correctly, you can say the recluse Gotama has the threefold true knowledge, that is the recollection of past lives, the knowledge of the arising and passing away of beings, and the knowledge of the destruction of the taint. Okay, but this is, in a sense, this is a rejection of the type of omniscience that, according to the Buddhist text, the founder of the leader of the Jains, Vigantha Nataputta, claimed for himself. But according to the Buddhist tradition, the way they comment on this text, it doesn't mean that the Buddha was not omniscient in a qualified sense. And the way this is understood by the Pali commentators, the Buddha was omniscient in the sense that he could know whatever he wanted to know. Not that he knows everything all the time, or even that he knows everything at any one time, but whenever he wants to know something, he just has to direct his mind to it, and whatever he wants to know will become accessible to him. So his faculty of knowledge is without obstruction, but it doesn't mean that he's knowing everything all the time, or isn't that at any time he actually knows everything possible. Say that again. Yeah, it's not the sutra that's saying that, but this is the way the Pali commentators understand the Buddha's capacity for knowledge. Because they still want to ascribe omniscience to him in some sense, but they also, they realize that it's not possible to to regard him as being omniscient in the sense of knowing everything all the time, since he himself explicitly denies that. And also that leads to a lot of conceptual problems. To know, well, wisdom is the ability to know. It's not a particular thing that one knows. Yeah. In the sense that whatever he directs his mind to, he would be able to know. Yeah. 9. It doesn't have to be, but in the text one always finds them coming in this sequence. Yeah. Somehow would mean it has a sense of, it has several senses, complete, full, perfect, correct, right, proper. If I think, jung. It's also quite possible that during the time of the Buddha that just these terms were just used to ascribe to the Buddha on different occasions, and that the compilers of the canon wanted to have a fixed formula for as a way of characterizing the Buddha. And so they collected these principal terms all together and arranged them into this sequence. And so as a way, whenever introducing the Buddha in the text, they would introduce him with this string of terms, this series of terms. Yeah. Yeah, well, I think the 52 stages from the Avatamsaka Sutra, of course that would come much later. I don't know, it's all speculative how these terms are arose and how they came to be arranged in this sequence. Yeah. This Patisambhita Magga, it's available in a translation. It's published by the Pali Text Society. The translation is called The Path of Discrimination, I think. It's a pretty dry abstract word. And a lot of it is, well, if you like lists of terms, you might find it interesting. the path of discrimination available from the Pali Tech Society, or maybe they have a distributor, a U.S. distributor, Pariyatti Books. It's translated again by Bhikkhu Nyanamoli. Okay, any further questions? Okay, then we will close for the evening and continue next week, moving more rapidly through the sutta. Oh, I have to share with that. Okay, we do the dedication of merit. Akasata chibumata deva nagamahitika punyantang anumodhitva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasata chibumata deva nagamahitika punyantang anumodhitva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasata chibumata deva nagamahitika punyantang anumodhitva chirang rakantu mankarang. Etavata chaham hehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata chaham hehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhuta anumodantu.